the worse.
Richard saw Helen Roden into a cab and then went upstairs to his room. He took off his shirt and put it in the bathroom sink and left it to soak in cold water. He didn't want bloodstains on a one-day-old shirt. 3 days old, maybe, but not a brand-new garment. Questions. There were a lot of questions, but as always, the key would be finding the basic question, the fundamental question. Why would someone use violence to protect a case that was already watertight? First question. Was the case already watertight? He trawled through the day in his head and heard Alex Roden say, "It's as good as it gets, the best I've ever seen." Emerson had said, "It's the best done deal I ever saw." The mortician like Bellantonio had said, "It's the best crime scene I ever worked. I love it all." Those guys all had professional self-interest in play, of course, and pride, and expediency. But Reacher himself had seen Bellantonio's work and had said, "It's a cast-iron, solid gold slam dunk. It's Willie Mays under a fly ball." Was it? Yes, it was. It was Lou Gehrig with the bases loaded. It was as close to a certainty as human life offers. But that wasn't the fundamental question. He rinsed his shirt and wrung it out hard and spread it on the room heater, turned the heater on high and opened the window. There was no noise outside, just silence. New York City, it wasn't. It sounded like they rolled up the sidewalks at 9 o'clock. "I went to Indiana, but it was closed." He lay down on the bed, stretched out. Damp heat came off his shirt and filled the room with the smell of wet cotton. What was the fundamental question? Helen Roden's cassette tape was the fundamental question. James Barr's voice, low, hoarse, frustrated, his demand, "Get Jack Reacher for me." Why would he say that? Who was Jack Reacher in James Barr's eyes, fundamentally? That was the basic question. "The best crime scene I ever worked. The best I've ever seen." Why did he pay to park? "Will you keep an open mind? Get Jack Reacher for me." Jack Reacher stared at his hotel room ceiling. 5 minutes. 10. 20. Then he rolled over one way and pulled the cocktail napkin out of his back pocket. Rolled the other way and dialed the phone. Helen Roden answered after 8 rings. She sounded sleepy. He had woken her up. "It's Reacher," he said.
"Are you in trouble?"
"No, but I've got some questions. Is Barr awake yet?"
"No, but he's close. Rosemary went back to the hospital. She left me a message."
"What was the weather like last Friday at 5?
"The weather? Friday? It was kind of dull. Cloudy."
"Is that normal?"
"No, not really. It's usually sunny. Or else raining. This time of year it's usually one or the other, more likely sunny."
"Was it warm or cold?"
"Not cold, but not hot. It was comfortable, I guess."
"What did you wear to work?"
"What is this, a dirty phone call?"
"Just tell me."
"Same as I wore today. Pantsuit."
"No coat?"
"Didn't need one."
"Have you got a car?"
"A car? Yes, I've got a car. But I use the bus for work."
"Use your car tomorrow. I'll meet you at 8 o'clock in your office."
"What's this about?"
"Tomorrow," he said. 8 o'clock. Go back to sleep now."
He hung up, rolled off the bed and checked his shirt. It was warm and wet, but it would be dry by morning. He hoped it wouldn't shrink.
Chapter 5.
Reacher woke at 6, took a long cold shower because the room was hot, but his shirt was dry. It was as stiff as a board and still the right size. There was no room service. He went out for breakfast. The roads were full of trucks, hauling gravel, hauling fill, mixing concrete, feeding the work zone's appetites. He dodged them and walked south toward the waterfront, through the gentrification frontier. He found a working man's diner with a basic menu. He drank coffee and ate eggs. He sat at a window and watched the street for aimless doorway lurkers or men in parked cars, because if he had been followed the night before, it was logical to assume he would be followed again. So he kept his eyes open, but he saw nobody. Then he walked the length of First Street, north. The sun was up on his right. He used store windows as mirrors and watched his back. Plenty of people were going his way, but none of them was following him. He guessed whoever it was would be waiting for him in the plaza, ready to confirm what he expected to see. The witness went to the lawyer's office. The fountain was still going. The pool was nearly half full. The tributes were still there, neatly lined up. Another day older, a little more faded, a little more wilted. He figured they would be there for a week or so, until after the last of the funerals. Then they would be removed, discreetly, maybe in the middle of the night, and the city would move on to the next thing. He sat for a moment on the NBC monolith, with his back to the tower, like a guy wasting time because he was early. Which he was. It was only 7:45. There were other people in the same situation. They stood around, singly or in groups of two or three, smoking last cigarettes, reading the morning news, chilling before the daily grind. Reacher looked first at men on their own with newspapers. That was a pretty traditional surveillance cover, although in his opinion it was due for replacement with a new exiled smoker cover. Guys standing near doorways and smoking were the new invisibles. Or guys on cell phones. You could stand there with a Nokia up to your ear forever, and nobody thought twice. In the end, he settled on a guy who was smoking and talking on a cell phone. He was a short man of about 60, maybe more. A damaged man. There was a permanent, lopsided tension in the way he held himself. An old spinal injury, maybe, or busted ribs that had been badly set years ago. Whatever it was, it made him look uncomfortable and querulous. He wasn't the type of guy who would happily converse at length. But there he was, on his phone, just talking, aimlessly. He had thin gray hair, recently barbered, but not stylishly. He was in a double-breasted suit that had been expensively tailored, but not in the United States. It was square and boxy, too heavy for the weather. Polish, maybe, or Hungarian. Eastern European, certainly. His face was pale and his eyes were dark. They didn't glance Reacher's way, even once. Reacher checked his watch. 7:55. He slid off the shiny granite and walked into the tower's lobby. Grigor Olinsky stopped pretending and dialed an actual number on his phone. "He's here," he said. "He just went up."
"Did he see you?" the Zek asked.
"Yes, I'm sure he did."
"So make that the last time. Now you stay in the shadows."
Reacher found Helen Roden already at her desk. She looked settled in, like she had been there a long time already. She was in the same black suit, but her shirt was different. It was a simple scoop neck, not tight. It was china blue and matched her eyes exactly. Her hair was tied back in a long ponytail. Her desk was covered with legal books. Some were face down, some were face up. They were all open. She had about 8 pages of notes going on a yellow legal pad. References, case notes, decisions, precedents.
"James Barr is conscious," she said. "Rosemary called me at 5 this morning."
"Is he talking?"
"Only to the doctors. They won't let anyone else near him yet. Not even Rosemary herself."
"What about the cops?"
"They're waiting. But I'll need to be there first. I can't let him talk to the cops without representation."
"What is he saying to the doctors?"
"That he doesn't know why he's there. That he doesn't remember anything about Friday. The doctors say that's to be expected. Amnesia is predictable with head injuries, possibly covering several days before the trauma. Several weeks, sometimes."
"Where does that leave you?"
"With 2 big problems. First, he might be faking the amnesia, and that's actually very hard to test either way. So now I'm going to have to find a specialist opinion on that, too. And if he isn't faking, we're in a real gray area. If he's sane now, and he was sane before, but he's missing a week, then how can he get a fair trial? He won't be able to participate in his own defense. Not if he hasn't got the slightest idea what anyone is talking about. And the state put him in that position. They let him get hurt. It was their jail. They can't do that and then go ahead and try him."
"What's your father going to think?"
"He's going to fight it, tooth and nail. Obviously. No prosecutor can afford to admit the possibility that amnesia might screw up a trial. Otherwise, everyone would jump right on it. Everyone would be looking to get beat up in pretrial detention. Suddenly, nobody would be able to remember anything."
"It must have happened before." Helen nodded.
"It has."
"So what do the law books say?"
"I'm reading them now, as you can see. Dusky versus the United States, Wilson versus the United States."
"And?"
"There are lots of ifs and buts."
Reacher said nothing. Helen looked straight at him.
"It's spinning out of control," she said. "Now there'll be a trial about a trial. It's something that might need to go all the way to the Supreme Court. I'm not equipped for that. And I don't want that. I don't want to be the lawyer who gets people off on weird technicalities. That's not who I am. And it's a label I can't afford right now."
"So plead him guilty. And the hell with it."
"When you called me last night, I thought you were going to walk in here this morning and tell me he's innocent."
"Dream on," Reacher said. She looked away. "But," he said. She looked back.
"There's a but."
He nodded. "Unfortunately."
"What's the but?"
"He's not quite as guilty as I thought he was."
"How?"
"Get your car and I'll show you." They rode down together to a tenants-only underground parking garage. There were NBC broadcast trucks in there, and cars, and pickups, and SUVs of various makes and vintages. There was a new blue Mustang convertible with an NBC sticker in the windshield. And Yanni's, probably, Reacher thought. It was right for her. She would drive top down on her days off, and top up during the work week, to keep her hair okay for the cameras. Or maybe she used a lot of spray. Helen Roden's ride was a small, dark green sedan so anonymous Reacher didn't know what it was. A Saturn, maybe. It was unwashed and not new. It was a graduate student's car, the sort of thing a person uses until a first salary kicks in and lease payments become affordable. Reacher knew all about lease payments. Baseball on the TV carried a lot of commercials. Every half inning and every call to the bullpen.
"Where are we going?"
Helen asked. "South," Reacher said. He racked his seat back and crunched a whole lot of stuff in the footwell behind him. She had her seat close to the wheel, even though she wasn't a short woman. He ended up looking at her more or less from behind.
"What do you know?"
she asked. "It's not what I know," he said. "It's what James Barr knows."
"About what?"
"About me." She came up out of the garage and started south down a street parallel with First. 8 o'clock in the morning, the rush hour traffic was still heavy, going the opposite way from the afternoon rush, he guessed.
"What does James Barr know about you?"
she asked. "Something that made him want me here," he said.
"He ought to hate you."
"I'm sure he does, but he still wanted me here." She crawled south toward the river. "He never met me before," Reacher said. "Never saw me again afterward. We knew each other for 3 weeks, more than 14 years ago."
"He knew you as an investigator, someone who broke a tough case."
"A case he thought couldn't be broken. He watched me do it every step of the way. He had a front row seat. He thought I was an investigative genius."
"That's why he wanted you here?"
Reacher nodded. "I spent last night trying to live up to his opinion." They crossed the river on a long iron trestle. The sun was on their left. The wharf was on their right. The slow gray water moved listlessly past it. "Go west now," Reacher said. She made a right and took a two-lane county road. There were bait stores on the riverbank and shacks selling barbecue and beer and crushed ice.
"But this case was already broken," she said. "He knew that."
"This case was only halfway broken," Reacher said. "That's what he knew."
"Halfway?"
Reacher nodded, even though he was behind her. "There's more to this case than Emerson saw," he said. "Barr wanted someone else to understand that, but his first lawyer was lazy. He wasn't very interested. That's why Barr got so frustrated."
"What more is there?"
"I'll show you."
"A lot?"
"I think so."
"So why didn't he just lay out the facts, whatever they are?"
"Because he couldn't. And because nobody would have believed him anyway."
"Why? What the hell happened here?"
There was a highway cloverleaf ahead, just like he had hoped. "I'll show you," he said again. "Take the highway north." She powered the little car through the ramp and merged with the traffic. There was a mixed stream flowing north. 18-wheelers, panel trucks, pickups, cars. The road recrossed the river on a concrete bridge. The wharf was visible to the east, in the distance. The city center was ahead, on the right. The highway rose gently on its stilts. Helen drove onward, with the roofs of low, edge-of-town buildings flashing past on the left and the right. "Be ready to take the spur that runs behind the library," Reacher said. It was going to be a right exit. It was announced well in advance with a sign. The broken line separating the right lane from the center lane became a solid line. Then the solid line became a narrow wedge. The through traffic was forced away to the left. The exit lane angled slightly right. They stayed in it. The wedge grew wider and was filled in with bold, cross-hatched lines. Up ahead were yellow drums. They passed them by, onto the spur that would lead behind the library. Reacher twisted in his seat and checked the rear window. Nobody behind them. "Go slow," he said. 200 yards ahead, the spur started to curve, behind the library, behind the black glass tower. The roadbed was wide enough for 2 lanes, but the radius was too tight to make it safe for 2 lanes to run side by side at high speed into the corner. Traffic engineers had thought better of it. They had advised a gentler trajectory. They had marked out a single lane through the curve. It was a little wider than a normal lane, to allow for misjudgments. It started way on the left, and then swung sharply to the right and cut across the apex of the curve at a more shallow angle.
"Go real slow now," Reacher said.
The car slowed. Way up ahead of them on the left was a crescent moon shape of white cross-hatching. Beginning right next to them on the right was a long, thin triangle of white cross-hatching. Just lines of paint on the blacktop, but they shepherded people along and kept them safe. "Pull over," Reacher said. "Here, on the right."
"Can't stop here," Helen said.
"Like you had a flat. Just pull over, right here." She braked hard and turned the wheel and steered onto the cross-hatched no-man's land on their right. They felt the thick painted lines thumping under the tires, a juttery little rhythm. It slowed as she slowed. She stopped.
"Back up a little," Reacher said.
She backed up, like she was parallel parking against the concrete parapet.
"Now forward a yard," Reacher said.
She drove forward a yard.
"Okay," he said.
He wound his window down. The traffic lane on their left was clear and smooth, but the cross-hatched no-man's land they were stopped on was covered with grit and trash and debris blown across it by years of passing vehicles. There were cans and bottles and detached mud flaps and tiny cubes of broken headlight glass and plastic splinters from old fender benders. Far away to the left, the through traffic rumbled north on a separate bridge. There was a constant stream over there, but they sat for a whole minute before anyone else came the way they had taken. A lone pickup passed close on their left and rocked them with its slipstream. Then the spur went quiet again.
"Not busy," Reacher said.
"It never is," Helen said. "This doesn't really go anywhere people need to get. It was a total waste of money. But I guess they've always got to be building something."
"Look down," Reacher said. The highway was raised up on tall stilts. The roadbed was maybe 40 feet above ground level. The parapet wall was 3 feet high. Beyond it, ahead and to their right, was the upper story of the library building. It had an intricate cornice, carved from limestone, and a slate roof. It felt close enough to touch.
"What?"
Helen asked. Reacher pointed with his thumb and then leaned way back so she could see across him. Directly to their right was an unobstructed view down into the plaza with a perfectly straight line of sight along the narrow bottleneck between the end of the ornamental pool and the plaza wall. And beyond it, dead ahead, perfectly aligned, was the door of the DMV office. "James Barr was a sniper," Reacher said. "Not the best, not the worst. But he was one of ours, and he trained for more than 5 years. And training has a purpose. It takes people who aren't necessarily very smart, and it makes them seem smart by beating some basic tactical awareness into them until it becomes instinctive."
"I don't understand."
"This is where a trained sniper would have fired from, up here on the highway. Because from here, he's got his targets walking directly toward him in a straight line, single file, into a bottleneck. He sets up with one aiming point and never has to vary it. His targets just walk into it, one after the other. Shooting from the side is much harder. The targets are passing right to left in front of him relatively quickly. He's got to figure in deflection compensation. He's got to move the rifle after each shot."
"But he didn't fire from here."
"That's my point. He should have, but he didn't."
"So?"
"He had a minivan. He should have parked it right where we are now, on this exact spot. He should have climbed through into the back seat and opened the sliding door. He should have fired from inside the minivan, Helen. It had tinted windows. The few cars that passed him wouldn't have seen a thing.
He should have fired his 6 shots with the much easier aim, and the 6 cartridge cases would have ejected inside the van. And then he should have shut the door and climbed back into the driver's seat and driven away. It would have been a much better firing position, and he would have left nothing at all behind. No physical evidence of any kind, because nothing would have touched anything, except his tires would have touched the road.
It's farther away. It's a longer distance to shoot.
It's about 70 yards. Barr was reliable at 5 times that distance. Any military sniper is. With an M1A supermatch, 70 yards is the same thing as point-blank range.
Someone would have gotten his plate number. There's always some traffic. They would have remembered him being here afterward.
His plates were covered with mud, probably on purpose. It would have been a great getaway. In 5 minutes, he would have been 5 miles away. Much better than threading through the traffic on the surface streets.
Helen Roden said nothing.
And he was expecting it to be sunny, Reacher said. You told me it usually is. 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the sun would have been in the west. Behind him, he would have been firing out of the sun. That's an absolutely basic preference for a sniper.
Sometimes it rains.
That would have been okay, too. It would have washed his tire tracks out of this grit. Either way around, he should have been up here in his van. Every reason in the world says he should have been up here in his van.
But he wasn't.
Evidently.
Why not?
We should get back to your office. That's where you need to be now. You've got a lot of strategizing to do.
Helen Roden sat down at her desk. Reacher walked to her window and looked out into the plaza. Looked for the damaged man in the boxy suit. Didn't see him.
What strategizing?
Helen asked.
Barr made a choice about where to shoot from, that's all. And it wasn't a great choice, according to you. According to some 14-year-old military theory that he probably forgot all about the day he quit the service.
They don't forget, Reacher said.
I'm not convinced.
That's why he walked out on Chapman. Chapman wasn't going to be convinced either. That's why he asked for me.
And you are convinced?
I'm looking at a situation where a trained sniper passed up an excellent location in favor of a much worse one.
He used a parking garage in Kuwait City. You said so yourself.
Because that was a good location. It was directly in line with the apartment building's door. The 4 guys were walking directly toward him. They went down like dominoes.
This is 14 years later. He's not as good as he was, that's all.
They don't forget, Reacher said again.
Whatever. How does it make him less guilty?
Because if a person chooses a terrible B instead of a great A, there has to be a reason for it. And reasons have implications.
What was his reason?
It had to be a real good one, didn't it? Because he trapped himself inside a building, down at street level, in a congested area, with a much harder shot, in a place whose very nature made it the best crime scene a 20-year veteran like Emerson has ever seen.
Okay. Tell me why he would do that.
Because he was literally going out of his way to leave every last piece of evidence he could. She stared at him.
That's crazy.
It was a great crime scene. Everyone was so happy with how great it was, they never stopped to realize it was way too great. Me included. It was like Crime Scene 101, Helen. It was what they must have given Bill Antonio on his first day in college. It was too good to be true. Therefore, it wasn't true. Everything was wrong with it. Like, why would he wear a raincoat? It was warm, and it wasn't raining, and he was in a car, and he was never outside. He wore it so he could scrape unique fibers off it onto the pillar. Why would he wear those stupid shoes? You look at a pair of shoes like that, and you just know they track every last piece of crap around. Why did he shoot out of the dark? So that people would see his muzzle flash and pinpoint the location so they could go up there afterward and find all the other clues. Why would he scrape his rifle on the wall? That's a $2,500 purchase. Why didn't he take the traffic cone away with him? It would have been easier just to throw it in the back of his van than leave it there.
This is crazy, Helen said.
Two clinchers, Reacher said. Why did he pay to park? That bothered me from the start. I mean, who does that? But he did. And he did it just so he could leave one little extra clue. Nothing else makes any sense. He wanted to leave a quarter in the meter with his prints on it, just to tie it all in a nice little bow, to connect it with the shell case, which he probably also left there on purpose.
It fell in a trench.
He could have gotten it out. There was plenty of wire lying around, according to Bellantonio's report. It would have taken a second and a half.
Helen Roden paused. What's the other clincher?
That's easy, once you start looking through the right end of the telescope. He wanted to be looking at the pool from the south, not the west. That was crucial. He wanted to be looking at it lengthwise, not sideways.
Why?
Because he didn't miss, Helen. He fired into the pool deliberately. He wanted to put a bullet in the water, down the long, diagonal axis, from a low angle, just like a ballistics tank, just so it could be found later, undamaged, just so it could tie his barrel to the crime. Sideways wouldn't have worked for him. Not enough travel distance through the water. The bullet would have hit the wall too hard. It would have gotten damaged.
But why the hell would he do all that?
Richard didn't answer.
Remorse? For 14 years ago? So he could be found and punished?
Reacher shook his head. He would have confessed as soon as they found him. A remorseful person would have been wanting to confess.
So why did he do all that?
Because he was made to, Helen. Simple as that.
She stared at him.
Someone forced him to do it, Reacher said. He was forced to do it, and he was forced to take the blame for it. He was told to go home afterward and wait for the arrest. That's why he took the sleeping pill. He was probably going crazy, sitting there waiting for the shoe to fall.
Helen Roden said nothing.
He was coerced, Reacher said. Believe it. It's the only logical explanation. He wasn't a lone nutcase. That's why he said, they've got the wrong guy. It was a message. He was hoping someone would pick up on it. He meant they should be looking for the other guy. The guy who made him do it. The guy he feels is more responsible.
Helen Roden said nothing.
The puppet master, Reacher said.
Reacher checked the plaza again from the window. The ornamental pool was about two-thirds full. The fountain was splashing merrily. The sun was out. There were no loiterers visible. Helen Roden got up from her desk, just stood there behind it.
I should be turning cartwheels, she said.
He still killed 5 people.
But if the coercion was substantial, it's going to help him.
Reacher said nothing.
What do you think it was? A double dare? Some kind of thrill-seeking?
Maybe, Reacher said, but I doubt it. On the face of it, James Barr is 20 years too old for double dares. That's a kid thing. And they'd have done it from the highway anyway. They would have wanted to survive, to do it again.
So what was it?
Something else entirely. Something real.
Should we take it to Emerson?
No, Reacher said.
I think we should.
There are reasons not to.
Like?
For one, Emerson's got the best done deal he ever saw. He's not going to pick at the seams now. No cop would.
So what should we do?
We should ask ourselves three basic questions, Reacher said. Like who, and how, and why. It was a transaction. We need to figure out who benefits. Because James Barr certainly didn't.
The who was whoever set those guys on you last night. Because he liked the way the transaction was going and he didn't want the boat rocked by some new guy showing up.
Correct, Reacher said.
So I need to look for that person.
You might not want to do that.
Why wouldn't I?
It might get your client killed, Reacher said.
He's in the hospital, guarded night and day.
Your client isn't James Barr, it's Rosemary Barr. You need to think about what kind of a threat can have made James Barr do what he did. He was looking at life without parole at best, getting strapped to the gurney at worst. He knew that well in advance. He must have. So why would he go along? Why would he walk meekly into all that? It had to have been one hell of an effective threat, Helen. And what's the only thing Barr's got to lose? No wife, no kids, no family at all, except a sister. Helen Roden said nothing. He was told to keep quiet, to the end, obviously. That's why he asked for me. It was like a coded communication, because the puppet can't talk about the puppet master, not now, not ever, because the threat is still out there. I think he might be trading his life for his sister's, which gives you a big problem. If the puppet master sees you poking around, he'll think the puppet talked. That's why you can't go to Emerson.
But the puppet didn't talk. You figured it out.
We could put an announcement in the paper. Think anyone would believe it?
So what should I do?
Nothing, Reacher said. There's nothing you can do, because the more you try to help James Barr, the more likely you are to get Rosemary Barr killed for it.
Helen Roden was quiet for a long moment. Can we protect her? She asked.
No, Reacher said. We can't. There's only two of us. We'd need four guys minimum and a safe house. That would cost a lot of money.
Helen Roden came out from behind her desk, walked around, and stood next to Reacher and gazed out of the window. She put her hands on the sill, lightly, like a pianist's on a keyboard. Then she turned around and leaned against the glass. She was fragrant, some clean scent a little like soap. "You could look for him," she said.
"Could I?" he answered. Nothing in his voice.
She nodded. He made a mistake. He gave you a reason that's not connected to James Barr. Not directly. He set those boys on you. Therefore, you've got a legitimate interest in finding their employer. An independent interest. You could go after him, and he wouldn't necessarily conclude that James Barr had talked.
I'm not here to help the defense.
Then look at it as helping the prosecution. If two people were involved, then two people deserve to go down. Why let the patsy take the fall on his own?
Reacher said nothing.
Just look at it as helping me,
Helen said.
Grigor Linsky dialed his cell phone.
"They're back in her office," he said. "I can see both of them in the window."
Chapter 6 Reacher rode the elevator to the top of the black glass tower and found a maintenance stairwell that led to the roof. He came out through a triangular metal hutch next to the water tank and the elevator winding gear. The roof was gray tar paper covered with gravel. It was 15 stories up, which wasn't much in comparison with some cities, but it felt like the highest point in Indiana. He could see the river to the south. South and west, he could see where the raised highway separated. He walked to the northwest corner, and wind whipped at him and flattened his shirt against his body and his pants against his legs. Directly below him, the highway spur curled around behind the library and the tower and ran away due east. Far beyond it, in the distance, the northward spur carried on straight and met a cloverleaf about 2 miles away in the haze. A long, straight road came off the cloverleaf and ran back toward him. He fixed its position in his mind, because that was the road he wanted. He rode down to the lobby and set out, walking. At street level, the air was warm and still. He went north and west, which meant he missed the sports bar by a block. The road he wanted came in at a shallow angle south of it and diverted him away. It was straight and wide, 4 lanes. Closest to downtown, it had small, run-down establishments. There was a gun store with heavy mesh on the windows. There was a barber shop with a sign, "Any style, $7." There was an old-fashioned motor court on a lot that once must have stood on the edge of town. Then there was a raw cross street, and beyond it, the lots got bigger and the buildings got newer. Fresh commercial territory. No existing leases, nothing to tear down. Once virgin land, now paved over. He kept on walking, and after a mile he passed a fast food drive-thru, then a tire store. 4 new radials, $99. Then a lube franchise and a dealership for small cars from Korea. America's best warranty. He looked ahead because he figured he was getting close. Are you a hooker? No way. I work at the auto parts store. Not an auto parts store. The auto parts store. Maybe the only one. Or at least the main one. The biggest one, which in any city is always right there on the same strip as the tire stores and the auto dealers and the lube shops, which in any city is always a wide new strip near a highway cloverleaf. Cities are all different, but they're also all the same. He spent 10 minutes hiking past a Ford dealership with about 1,000 new pickup trucks lined up shoulder to shoulder with their front wheels up on ramps. Behind them was a giant inflatable gorilla tied down with guy wires. The wires had tinsel bunting attached to them. Beyond the new trucks were old trucks. Trade-ins, Reacher guessed, looking for new homes. Beyond the used lot was a fire road, and then an auto parts store. It was a franchise operation, long and low, neat and clean. New blacktop in the lot, urgent messages in the windows. Cheap oil filters, cheap antifreeze, guaranteed brake parts, super duty truck batteries. The parking lot was about a quarter full. There were slammed Hondas with wide pipes and blue headlight bulbs and rubber band tires on chrome wheels. There were listing pickup trucks with broken springs. There were tired sedans halfway through their third 100,000 miles. There were 2 cars alone together in the end bays. The store staff's cars, Reacher figured. They weren't allowed to park in the prime front and center slots, but they wanted their rides where they could see them through the windows. One was a 4-cylinder Chevy, and the other was a small Toyota SUV. The Chevy had chromed silhouettes of reclining women on the mud flaps, which made the Toyota the redhead's car. That was Reacher's conclusion. He went inside. The air was set very cold and smelled of sharp chemical flavors. There were maybe a half dozen customers walking around, looking. At the front of the store were racks full of glass and chrome things. Jessup accessories reach a guest. In back were racks of things in red cardboard boxes. Clutch plates, brake pads, radiator hoses, stuff like that, he guessed. Parts. He had never put parts on a car. In the army, there had been guys to do it for him. And since the army, he had never had a vehicle of his own. Between the glamour stuff and the boring stuff was a service corral made of four counters boxed together. There were registers and computers and thick paper manuals. Behind one of the computers was a tall boy somewhere in his early 20s, not someone Reacher had seen before, not one of the five from the sports bar, just a guy. He looked to be in charge. He was wearing red coveralls. A uniform, Reacher guessed, partly practical and partly suggestive of the kind of thing an Indy 500 pit mechanic might wear, like a symbol, like an implied promise of fast, hands-on help with all kinds of matters automotive. The guy was a manager, Reacher guessed, not the franchise owner, not if he drove a four-cylinder Chevy to work. His name was embroidered on the left of his chest, Gary. Up close, he looked sullen and unhelpful. I need to speak with Sandy, Reacher said to him, the redhead. She's in back right now, the guy called Gary said. Shall I go through, or do you want to go get her for me? What's this about?
Personal.
She's here to work.
It's a legal matter.
You're not a cop.
I'm working with a lawyer.
I need to see some ID.
No, Gary, you don't. You need to go get Sandy.
I can't. I'm short-staffed today.
You could call her on the phone. Or page her.
The guy called Gary just stood still. Did nothing. Reacher shrugged and bypassed the corral of counters and headed for a door in back marked No Admittance. It would be an office or a lunchroom, he guessed, not a stockroom. A place like that, stock was unloaded directly onto the shelves. No hidden inventory. Reacher knew how modern retail worked. He read the papers people left behind on buses and in diner booths. It was an office, small, maybe 10 by 10, dominated by a large white laminate desk with oily handprints on it. Sandy was sitting behind it, wearing red coveralls. Hers looked a whole lot better than Gary's. They were cinched in tight around her waist with a belt. The zipper was open about 8 inches. Her name was embroidered on the left, displayed a lot more prominently than Gary's was. Reacher figured that if he owned the franchise, he would have Sandy working the counter and Gary in the office. No question.
We meet again, he said.
Sandy said nothing, just looked up at him. She was working with invoices. There was a stack of them on her left and a stack of them on her right. One of them was in her hand, frozen in midair on its journey from one stack to the other. She looked smaller than Reacher remembered, quieter, less energetic, duller, deflated.
We need to talk, he said, don't we?
I'm very sorry for what happened, she said.
Don't apologize. I wasn't offended. I just want to know how it went down.
I don't know how.
You do, Sandy. You were there.
She said nothing, just placed the invoice on top of the stack to her right and used her fingers to line it up exactly.
Who set it up? Reacher asked.
I don't know.
You must know who told you about it.
Jeb,
she said. Jeb?
Jeb Oliver, she said. He works here. We hang out sometimes.
Is he here today?
No, he didn't show.
Reacher nodded. The guy called Gary had said, I'm short-staffed today.
Did you see him again last night, afterward?
No, I just ran for it.
Where does he live?
I don't know. With his mother somewhere. I don't know him that well.
What did he tell you?
That I could help with something he had to do.
Did it sound like fun?
Anything sounds like fun on a Monday night in this town. Watching a barn plank warp sounds like fun.
How much did he pay you?
Sandy didn't answer.
A thing like that, nobody does it for free, Reacher said.
$100, she said.
What about the other four guys?
Same for them.
Who were they?
His buddies.
Who came up with the plan? The brothers thing.
It was Jeb's idea. You were supposed to start pawing me, only you didn't.
You improvised very well. She smiled a little, like it had been a small, unscripted success in a life that held very few of them. How did you know where to find me? Reacher asked.
We were cruising in Jeb's truck, around and around, kind of standing by. Then he got word on his cell.
Who called him?
I don't know.
Would his buddies know?
I don't think so. Jeb likes to know things that nobody else knows.
You want to lend me your car?
My car?
I need to go find Jeb.
I don't know where he lives.
You can leave that part to me. But I need wheels.
I don't know.
I'm old enough to drive, Reacher said. I'm old enough to do lots of things. And I'm pretty good at some of them. She half smiled again because he was using her own line from the night before. She looked away, and then she looked back at him, shy but curious.
Was I any good?
She asked.
You know, last night, with the act?
You were great, he said. I was preoccupied, or I would have given up on the football in a heartbeat.
How long would you need my car for?
How big is this town?
Not very.
Not very long, then.
Is this a big deal?
You got $100. So did four other guys. That's $500 right there. My guess is Jeb kept another $500 for himself. So someone paid $1,000 to put me in the hospital. That's a moderately big deal. For me, anyway.
I wish I hadn't gotten involved now.
It turned out okay.
Am I in trouble?
Maybe, Reacher said. But maybe not. We could deal. You could lend me your car and I could forget all about you.
Promise?
No harm, no foul, Reacher said. She ducked down and lifted her purse off the floor, rooted through and came out with a set of keys.
It's a Toyota,
she said. I know, Reacher said. End of the row next to Gary's Chevy.
How did you know that?
Intuition, he said. He took the keys and closed the door on her and headed back to the corral of counters. Gary was ringing some guy up for some unidentifiable purchase. Reacher waited in line behind him, got to the register inside about 2 minutes. I need Jeb Oliver's address, he said.
Why?
Gary said. A legal matter.
I want to see some ID.
You had a criminal conspiracy running out of your store. If I were you, the less I knew about it, the better.
I want to see something.
What about the inside of an ambulance? That's the next thing you're going to see, Gary, unless you give me Jeb Oliver's address. The guy paused a moment, glanced beyond Reacher's shoulder at the line forming behind him, apparently decided that he didn't want to start a fight he knew he couldn't win, with a whole bunch of people watching. So he opened a drawer and took out a file and copied an address onto a slip of paper torn off the top of a memo pad provided by an oil filter manufacturer.
North of here, he said. About 5 miles.
Thank you, Reacher said, and took the slip of paper. The redhead's Toyota started on the first turn of the key. Reacher let the engine idle and racked the seat back and adjusted the mirror, clipped his belt, and propped the slip of paper against the instrument panel. It meant he couldn't see the tachometer, but he wasn't very interested in whatever information that dial might supply. All he cared about was how much gas was in the tank, and there looked to be more than enough for 5 miles out and 5 miles back. Jeb Oliver's address was nothing more than a house number on a rural route, easier to find than a road with a name like Elm Street or Maple Avenue. In Reacher's experience, some towns had more roads named after trees than trees themselves. He moved out of the parking lot and drove north to the highway Cloverleaf. There was the usual forest of signs. He saw the route number he wanted. It was going to be a dogleg, right and then left, east and then north. The little SUV hummed along okay. It was tall for its width, which made it feel tippy on the turns, but it didn't fall over. It had a small engine that kept itself working hard. The interior smelled of perfume. The west-east part of the dogleg was some kind of a major county road, but after the turn north, the black top narrowed and the shoulders grew ragged. There was agriculture going on to the left and the right. Some kind of a winter crop was planted in giant circles. Radial irrigation booms turned slowly. The corners where the booms didn't reach were unplanted and stony. Superimposing circles on squares wasted more than 21% of every acre. But Reacher figured that might be an efficient trade-off in places where land was plentiful and irrigation hardware wasn't. He drove 4 more miles through the fields and passed a half-dozen tracks with mailboxes at the end of them. The mailboxes were painted with numbers, and the tracks led away west and east to small, sway-backed farm dwellings maybe 200 yards off the road. He watched the numbers and slowed before he got to the Oliver place. It had a mailbox like all the others, up on a post, made out of 2 figure-8 concrete blocks stacked end on end. The number was daubed in white on a weathered plywood rectangle wired to the concrete. The track was narrow, with 2 muddy ruts flanking a weedy center hump. There were sharp tire tracks in the mud. New treads, wide, aggressive, from a big truck. Not the kind of tires you bought at the 99 bucks for 4 place. Reacher turned the Toyota in and bumped down the track. At the end of it, he could see a clapboard farmhouse with a barn behind it and a clean red pickup truck next to it. The truck was turned nose out, and it had a massive chrome radiator grill. A Dodge Ram, Reacher figured. He parked in front of it and got out. The house and the barn were about 100 years old, and the truck was about 1 month old. It had the big Hemi motor and the crew cab and 4-wheel drive and huge tires. It was probably worth more than the house, which was badly maintained and 1 winter away from serious trouble. The barn was no better, but it had new iron clasps on the doors with a bicycle U-lock through them. There was no sound except for a distant rainfall hiss as the irrigation booms turned slowly in the fields. No activity anywhere. No traffic on the road, no dogs barking. The air was still and full of the sharp smell of fertilizer and earth. Reacher walked to the front door and knocked twice with the flat of his hand. No response. He tried again. No response. He walked around to the back of the house and found a woman sitting on a porch glider. She was a lean and leathery person, wearing a faded print dress and holding a pint bottle of something golden in color. She was probably 50, but she could have passed for 70, or 40 if she took a bath and got a good night's sleep. She had 1 foot tucked up underneath her and was using the other to scoot the glider slowly back and forth. She wasn't wearing shoes.
"What do you want?"
she said.
"Jeb," Reacher said.
"Not here."
"He's not at work, either."
"I know that."
"So where is he?"
"How would I know?"
"Are you his mother?"
"Yes, I am. You think I'm hiding him here?" Go ahead and check.
Reacher said nothing. The woman stared at him and rocked the glider back and forth, back and forth.